Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you are the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey Jason, my name is Ben Lawrence. I'm a podcast creator in Sydney.
I first came across Jason in my local paper. He called himself a ghost hunter.
The first ghost I ever saw was my brother Peter's.
I could tell there was more to his story.
Two at a time.
Come on, men.
But if I'd known this call would lead to 7 years investigating a haunting real-life mystery and untangling Jason's dark past, I wonder if I would have picked up the phone in the first place.
Did you hear that?
Yep, something up here.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Ghost Hunter, an Audible original podcast, only on Audible.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Are you ready to start the second part?
I guess so. This is a lot longer story, but you know what? There's just so much to it.
He was,
you know, and it's just, I cut out a bunch.
I know. I mean,
but it's like some of these little stories are little, but they're just, that just tells you
what a horrible person he was.
How bad he was, you know?
Well, before we get in, I want to just say a couple more shout outs. Is that okay?
Oh,
do you mind?
Of course.
All right. These are the 5-star reviews that people have left us. That was H. McFall 0001, Three Girls, Two Dogs. Thank you so much.
That's a cute name.
Christy Lynn, Ohio.
Christy
Thank
Lynn.
You. Wally's Mom 3. Wally. Hi, Wally's Mom.
Wally, that's such a cute name.
It is. I love the name Wally. And KLH3641. Thank you guys for the awesome 5-star reviews. We really appreciate it. It makes our day.
I was just going to say, Jen, and I know you feel the same way because usually we're on the phone with each other, but when I see that, like, it makes my heart so happy.
I know. It does.
You know? Because it's like somebody's taking time out of their day to just be like, hey, good job. That means a lot.
And it makes us very appreciative.
And it makes me just feel like to do better.
Exactly.
I got to do better.
I know. You know? Oh, they like us. They really like us.
So thank you, really, from
really,
the bottom of our heart.
It's a huge ego boost, considering we don't have much ego or self-esteem or podcast self-esteem.
Low pod esteem.
Yeah.
I'm working on it.
And you got to remember, too, that we're moms, so we don't get a lot of kudos there either.
Mom.
So,
Mom, that's what you're supposed to do.
But anyway, we have four more names, and these are our new Patreon folk. And I'm sure Camille will be getting out the goodies.
The bags
shortly.
Are done. I just got to send them out. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow.
Big thank you for our new Patreons, Christine A., Jennifer Lynn. Awesome name, Jennifer, by the way.
I bet you're a better Jennifer than the Jennifer I know. I'm just saying.
No. But I'm also an L. Not Lynn, but I'm an L.
Floyd. Jennifer Floyd.
Yeah.
With
an Then a huge thanks to our friend Chaplain Tina.
Yay.
We love talking to you on Twitter, and we hope everybody else joins Twitter and comes talk to us at Our True Crime Pod.
And thank you.
We love talking to you all and finding, send us pictures of your animals. So,
that's cute.
Or your kids, or whatever. We like to share.
Whatever you love, whatever you want to share.
But anyway, you want to get back to the story?
I do, Jen. It's a
when we last left in Skidmore, Missouri.
I like that.
Yeah.
Keep going. I like that.
That's the Justice League.
Yeah.
That was Ted Knight, remember?
Oh, yeah, that was.
Yeah.
Aw.
Poor Ted.
Oh, he died. Okay, so where we last left off, we were discussing this town in Skidmore, Missouri, in which this man pretty much terrorized and reigned over with just such vengeance and harassment and all
and
that
he
good
scared
stuff.
Everybody and nobody wanted to say anything.
Nobody would ever come up against him. So today we're going to finish talking about that. You ready?
Well, part two.
This is part two. And so far, I think we have four parts.
Right.
So we don't kill our editor, Nico. We're going to do one, two, and then one, two next
right.
week.
This guy is a some biosh.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
All right. Ready?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Tarina was placed in a mental facility for about 3 weeks without her baby, mainly to protect her from Ken. She was then sent to live with the foster family in Nom Nopster. Because remember, she's still a kid. She's still a freshman in high school, I mean, age-wise.
And Nom Nopster is really the name of a town.
Knob Knobster is a, it's by Whiteman Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. It's outside of Kansas City. It's outside of Warrensburg, Missouri. Right. Remember when I went to Warrensburg? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So I just wanted
to. I partied in Knob Knobster.
I just wanted to clear that up for people that's not around these dates. It really is a town. There really is a town called Knob Knobster.
Yep. Spelled differently too, which is funny. Knob as in doorknob, but then Knobster is like mobster with an N.
Mm-hmm.
On June 19th, 1973, primarily on the basis of Tarina's testimony, a prosecutor named Fraze, F-R-A-Z-E, filed three criminal charges against Ken McElroy. They were rape, arson, and flourishing a deadly weapon. The prosecutor would later file an amended complaint alleging that McElroy had also assaulted Tarina on June 12th by, and this is the quote, kicking and slapping her, by pulling her hair, by exposing her to vulgar and obscene language, and by causing Tarina to exhibit herself nude before him, end quote. And I guess that would be because she's a minor, right?
Right, I would assume so.
It finally seemed that Ken McElroy might actually have to pay the price for his crimes.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen.
Ken McElroy had a lawyer named McFadden that we mentioned earlier who had not yet let him down. Three of the four cases, including the most serious ones, depended entirely on what? The testimony of one person. But remember Ken McElroy's code when it came to crimes, no witness, no case.
No time.
McElroy, he said, that should have been added. That's a good one. McElroy finally surrendered after cops threatened to take his children away and was released on $2,500 bond. Say what? $2,500.
You're kidding
me. Everything he's done. Nope.
We owe my husband more than that.
And but Tarina that was, and beat them and shot people.
But what year was this? 73?
Yes.
Let's do the inflation calculator and see how much that
it's
is.
It's still not very much for what he's, I mean, it's attempted murder, basically, but that's not what he was charged with.
Yeah.
But here we go. But put that in the back of your mind because it's going to come up again in a minute.
$14,422.47.
$15,000
for murder charges. Yeah.
He wasn't charged with murder, but well, all that but, stuff. Yeah, yeah. I got you. With Ken McElroy out and now on the hunt for the witness, which is Tarina, he told his friends he would give them $2,000 if they could find her. So he has enlisted his friends to find Tarina so he could take care of her and there wouldn't be a witness. Her original foster family that she had went to live with after she was in the mental facility for a little while, he found her, so they had to move her. He found her again. He would go and like stalk out the house and like wait outside the house and just sit in his truck. So like just sitting there in fear, the whole family, Tarina.
Terrorizing
seeing
them.
Seeing. Yeah. He's right there.
Domestic terrorism.
In November 1973, the court held a preliminary hearing. And because the incidents had occurred in Nottoway County, the charges had been filed there. The normal procedure would have been for the local magistrate to conduct the hearing. But in this case, as in somehow all cases involving Ken Rex McElroy, the magistrate, which later became a circuit judge, Montgomery Wilson, disqualified himself. Do you know why he might disqualify himself?
Was he threatened by any chance?
Montgomery, better known as Monty. Monty Wilson had grown up in Skidmore and had long feared Ken McElroy. Wilson's fear of Ken McElroy was known because he told a friend, I don't want anything to do with that man or I'll get killed. Now, this is a judge, magistrate.
Yeah.
Is that crazy or what? On November 9th, he issued an order disqualifying himself and sent the hearing to a magistrate, Clark Gore, who was located in Atchison County. That's the next door county.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the rape and arson charges, at which Tarina was the primary witness, Alice Wood denied having seen McElroy burn down the house.
No way.
Magistrate Gore heard evidence on the charge of flourishing a deadly weapon. Russ Johnson, Skidmore City Marshal and Special Deputy Sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
They need like one there. And also, coincidentally, Tarina's uncle testified that on June 11th, 1973, at approximately 11:30 p.m., he was with Ronald McNeely and Wayne Johnson when Ken McElroy approached them with a gun. So you have a witness here saying that you know where he was. The prosecuting attorney was determined to convict Ken McElroy of something, of anything. After Tarina passed a lie detector test and after the motel attendant confirmed that a man matching McElroy's description had rented the room in which he and Tarina had used at
right.
the Tic-Toe Motel, or whatever the heck the name was.
Tic-Toe. Oh, Lordy.
I love small town America. The prosecutor decided to file an additional 8 charges of child molestation against McElroy. Not only would each charge increase the chance of a conviction, but the molestation charges would be easier to prove because it's Tarina. She's underage.
Right.
She got pregnant by him, had a baby. Right? It's easier to prove. Of course, the prosecutor thinks this is going to be an easy win. Right. I mean, listen. But
I bet you it's not.
It's Ken McElroy. Ken comes up with a new plan. What's he going to do? How do you get her not to file these charges against you?
Do you kill her?
Well, there's that option, or the one that he's already done before. I just got to marry her, but now I got to get rid of the other one. Again, you know, similar to what I did earlier. So the problem was he was still currently married to Sharon, but fear not. He happened to know a really good lawyer that could handle a divorce in a timely manner and allow him to hurry up and marry Trina. It was his good lawyer that handled all of his affairs, McFadden. So just like that, all of those 11 charges were dropped because you can't be accused, I guess, of molesting your wife.
But she can't testify.
That's the thing.
Right. So the
but it's
charges,
okay because she lies and says it never happened anyway.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if she can't testify, there's nobody to say that he did.
Yep.
It's otherwise hearsay.
So there is one remaining charge. That was the 12th one, and that's flourishing a weapon. That went to trial sometime later in Gentry County. A key prosecution witness, ironically, he couldn't be found for the trial. Earlier, they knew where he was. He was going to come and say that he saw McElroy brandishing that weapon. And guess what? Here comes the trial. And they can't find him. So since they can't find him, McElroy was acquitted by the jury.
Of course he was.
So time for a count. Here's a little breakdown count. At this point, a total of 19 felony charges in 3 different counties between 1970 and 1973, that's only 3 years, have all been dismissed or resulted in an acquittal because the primary witness either declined to prosecute, changed his or her story, or couldn't be found.
That's Jesus.
19 felony counts in 3 counties? That's insane.
Well, he's got the power, it seems. Well, and people gave him the power.
That is such a nice segue, Jen. Thank you, because guess what?
I got the power.
That's right. Good old Ken Rex, as they call him in the documentary, is about to step it up. July 27th, 1976. 41-year-old farmer Romaine Henry had just returned from having new tires put on his truck. He's at home. One of his sons rush in and tells him that he's heard gunshots right down the gravel road. Mm. Romaine got in his pickup and drove over to investigate. As he got close, he recognized Ken McElroy's pickup parked along the right side of the road. And Romaine, you know, decided to keep going. He wasn't about to deal with that.
Uh-uh.
But as he went past, Ken McElroy steps out in the middle of the road, directly in front of Romaine, meaning he would hit him and run over with the truck. He's holding a shotgun in the air. Romaine braked. And as he did so, he noticed that there was another man who was younger, behind the wheel of the other pickup, his car.
Right.
Which I'm assuming is Larry, by the way. McElroy leaned in and stuck the shotgun about 3 inches from Romaine's face. "Were you the dirty son of a bitch over at my place in a white Pontiac?" McElroy demanded. Confused and scared, Romaine was looking down the barrel of a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Romaine said, "You know, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't have a white Pontiac. I have no idea what you're talking about." McElroy says, "You're a lying son of a bitch." He lowered the barrel and fired the shotgun. The blast tore a big hole in Romaine's stomach, splattered blood and pieces of flesh against the driver's door, and ripped holes in the panel. Romaine tried to move, but McElroy quickly pumped another shell into the chamber, thrust it in Romaine's face, and fired again. Romaine ducked just as the gun went off, but he felt the stinging of the pellets as they tore a huge gash in his forehead and cheek. Romaine barely escaped with his life, and McElroy was arrested the next day, charging him with assaulting Romaine Henry with the intent to kill him or do great bodily harm. No duh. Really?
Mm-hmm.
I would say murder, but whatever. McElroy's defense was simple from the very beginning, Jen.
Of course it was.
He wasn't there. He didn't do it. I mean, maybe somebody thought they saw him there, but it wasn't him. He didn't do it. I mean, Romaine Henry obviously had been shot. But they had to be mistaken about who had shot him.
Well, of course.
Even though Romaine Henry saw him right there and he was right there in his face 3 inches. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, Ken's never been in trouble at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a clean record.
He's an outstanding citizen. Five people other than McElroy and Romaine initially claimed to have knowledge of McElroy's whereabouts at the time of the shooting. Three people placed him on that road in the vicinity of Romaine's farm, and two swore he was at home. Were they at his house? How did they know he was at home? Whatever.
Well, it's because their word.
So here we go. Here comes our buddy. Lawyer McFadden begins constructing a defense. McFadden needed Romaine's story. He needed to pin down that timing, the exact timing. That's where it would be, because then they could prove that he was somewhere else. So McFadden had him repeat over and over. What time were you there? Are you positive? After you arrived home, what time was it? And he kept going on and on, drilling the same questions. Under McFadden's questioning, Romaine acknowledged the incident could have occurred, you know, 15 minutes either way. It wasn't a solid time, but it was about a 15-minute window. McFadden then asked Romaine, you know, hey, have you ever been convicted of a felony? No, Romaine answered. He hadn't. McFadden, you know, in the meantime.
True. He's not lying.
Well, McFadden had found that Romaine had been convicted of a common assault. You ready? Some 24 years ago when he was in a teenage fistfight.
Oh.
Romaine forgot about that. So now they could say that he was a liar.
Exactly. Right? That's on all stand, they needed. Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
McFadden is putting the case together during this time. And McElroy, you know, what's he going to do? You think he's going to sit by and do nothing?
Oh, hell no.
No. What's his quote? What's his? No witness, no crime.
No time.
So McElroy uses all this time to start going after the witnesses. Romaine had estimated that McElroy visited him, which is really stalked, I guess, because it's not like he's knocking on the door, at least 100 separate times.
Oh, Jesus.
McElroy was trying to provoke him into doing something foolish. That's what Romaine had guessed, such as coming after him with a gun or intimidating him. So then, therefore, that would all be, you know, see, he's after me. I'm not after him. He's after me. Romaine called the sheriff's department, complained, and said, can you please send somebody over to talk to him? Because I can't take this anymore. This is harassment. It's terrible.
Right.
The sheriff did drive by a couple times, Jen.
Oh, really?
But it was always when McElroy wasn't home. There's a man named Danny Kinder, and he was set to testify against McElroy because he had driven by and he'd seen the vehicle. So he could testify that he saw the vehicle there with Romaine's. Guess what happened? He starts getting threats on his life and his wife's and his children's life. So he had asked for police protection. And guess what? Police said, yeah, that's just not possible. We can't do that for you. He decided it wasn't worth it. Packed up the family and they moved to Florida. Word of goodness.
And they moved to Beverly Hills, that is.
The poor guy that just was going to say, I saw his pickup. I saw a pickup. Not even sure whose it was. I saw it. He starts getting death threats and all this stuff and has to move to Florida. I mean, come on. In the fall of 1976, prosecuting attorney Fraze was elected magistrate to replace good old Monty Wilson. Now, that's the one that was afraid of McElroy, right?
Right.
And Wilson has now been elected circuit judge. He's elected circuit judge and still afraid of this guy. The new prosecutor, her name was Amy Davis. Now, Amy Davis was young, and hungry, and naive. This was going to be her first big trial. So she was taking this over from the prosecuting attorney to the Romaine Henry case. Amy Davis also knew about McFadden and McElroy because she was working as a clerk for the prosecuting attorney when he was initially handling the rape case, the molestation, and the arson case. And frankly, she was pretty open that she did not like either man. She did not care for McElroy and really didn't like his attorney, McFadden, either.
Huh. They both seemed like such stand-up guys.
Right. Amy Davis was, however, confident. And the cops, by now, are hopeful that she will be able to get something to stick on McElroy with Romaine's, I guess, attempted murder case, correct?
Mm-hmm.
As she began getting the trial ready, Davis realized just how scared people were of Ken McElroy. The two other witnesses who had seen McElroy on the road close to the scene of the crime, remember they were the two that were going to come forward? They simply refused to testify. They just wouldn't do it. The trial was bizarre from the get-go. Davis noticed that several of the jurors were looking away from her as she recited her opening statements, almost as if, they already knew the outcome.
I think they did.
McElroy's testimony was consistent. He had been at home that afternoon until 6 p.m. and hadn't shot anybody.
Aw, what a good boy.
Right? Davis could not shake him on the cross-examination. Partly, she would admit to herself and others later that she was kind of intimidated by him. She also said that she could have sworn she saw hand signals coming from McFadden's associate to McElroy during the cross-examination. As a lawyer, could you imagine, say, like, hello, you know, and then if you say something, they're going to think you're crazy. But right. It's like, I see you making the little baseball signs over there or whatever. After 2 hours of deliberation, the jury voted.
Not guilty.
Unanimously for acquittal. When the clerk announced a verdict of not guilty, Davis felt certain that the jury had been tampered with. When the verdict was read, Romaine noticed McFadden, the lawyer, wink and smile at his client, McElroy. McElroy looked over at Romaine with a half-grin, half-sneer on his face. McElroy now knew that he was above the law.
Of course he is. Okay, let's take a minute here. This will be our commercial break.
Romaine Henry took it in stride and was excited to get on with his life, thinking this was all behind him. He really wanted the conviction, but you know what? He just was tired of putting up with this, with the harassment. He's just happy. He just wants it all gone, you know? Wrong. Doesn't stop. Of course it doesn't stop. It's McElroy. One October afternoon, Romaine met up with McElroy coming the other way on the road. McElroy made a U-turn and began following him. When Romaine turned into his field, McElroy stopped at the gate. Now, this is Romaine. It's his property, right?
Mm-hmm.
He saw McElroy lift something up to his shoulder and a second later heard the crack of a high-powered rifle and a bullet whiz about 2 feet over his head. Romaine, he just followed him to his field and he shoots him, like out of nowhere. It barely missed him. Romaine, in that second, made a decision. He climbed into his combine, and he started running it down a row of beans.
A row of beans?
Row of beans.
Beans, musical fruit.
More you eat, the more you
like beans.
Romaine Henry didn't even consider reporting the shooting. If a jury wouldn't convict McElroy for shooting him in the stomach and face, he knew they sure as hell wouldn't convict him for firing a rifle into the air, which was really right by him. It whizzed past him. At this time, with everything that McElroy had done to all the townsfolk, the community, they knew he was really out of control. The police were afraid of him.
Everybody was afraid of him.
People were afraid of him. Nobody would testify. Heck, the guy that just became the judge that went to school with him wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. So now we're about to take another look at something that happens, and this would be the antithesis of how everything unfolds. After all of this has taken place, we're now going to fast forward to the afternoon of April 25th, 1980. So we're in the 80s now, barely. Bo Bowenkamp. That's why I looked at you. Bo Bowenkamp was where he usually was, behind the meat counter, as his wife, Lois, sat at a small table nearby at the little market they owned in town called the B&B Market. Evelyn was working the checkout counter when a teen walked through the door. After about 10 minutes, the teenager and a young child approached the counter with a candy bar and a sack of cookies and asked for a pack of cigarettes, which cracked me up because back then you could buy cigarettes like Shelly and I did.
Right.
Evelyn rang up the order and she mentioned that the child needed to pay as well because the child had some candy. Evelyn returned the change to the teenager and again, noticing that the child was not giving money, asked about the candy again. Becoming distraught, the older girl took the candy from the younger child's hands and put it back. They exited the store, but Evelyn noticed the child still had some candy, so she yelled out to them. The teen flung around and threw the candy back into the store.
Oh, nice.
Now, this isn't an unusual thing to occur in a market, as, you know, it does with kids.
Right.
But these kids weren't just any kids.
They were McElroy's kids.
They were Ken Rex McElroy's kids.
That's why they were so polite and respectful.
Poor Evelyn. She knew what was coming because she knew who they were. And she was trying to explain to Lois. And Lois is like, I don't care. I don't know who that is. It doesn't, whatever. It doesn't bother me.
I know.
Right? Because who
cares?
Right? About 15 minutes later, McElroy, along with a woman, march into the store screaming obscenities. He had a knife, demanding to know which B-word accused his effing child of raiding the store. Evelyn, at this point, is now crying, and Lois was trying to remain calm. Evelyn said, you know, she would explain what had happened if they would just calm down and allow her to speak. They shut up long enough to hear the story, and seemingly happy, they departed the store, but it was far from over. Now, this is amazing that he goes and shoots. And for what? For a piece of candy? Because
she said something to his kids.
No, it's not her, though. He goes after the man. That's the thing.
But still.
Because he's the owner of the store. Whatever. That's whatever. 4 days pass. Then on Tuesday, April 29th, Lois noticed McElroy's Buick parked out in front of the tavern. Now, the tavern was the D&G Tavern, which was kind of like catty cornered across from the store, right? Small town. We're talking like 1 4-way stop.
Right.
When Lois walked out the front door at 6, her shift was over, she noticed McElroy sitting in the car a little ways down the street now. And he was watching them. He was watching the store. Seeing Lois, he backed out and began easing up the street towards her. Lois got into the car on the passenger side. She was waiting for Beau, who would be following her because the store's closed and he was closing up the store. As Lois waited, the Buick pulled in beside the station wagon on the driver's side. Lois stared straight ahead, but she could feel McElroy just staring at her, but she would not look at him. And she estimated later that it was probably 5 minutes of him up next to her staring at her, the side of her face as she looked straight ahead. Beau came out and he walked between the two vehicles and he was going to get in the car. And he started to open the driver's door of the station wagon. McElroy leaned over and he said in a low, clear voice, "Hey, is she still the boss in that store?" Beau said yes, and he got in the car.
Wow.
Okay, you know, it's not too bad, right? And so it begins. It's not long before McElroy and Tarina starts driving up and down the street, stalking out the Bowen Camp's house. Now, this is a small community, as we said, so it's really easy to find out where people live. Not real hard when you only have 400 people there.
And you can check, and your lawyer can find everything.
Exactly. So McElroy and Tarina would show up at all times of the day and night. Then the shooting started, shooting into the air right outside their house. Fed up, Lois reached out to a recently appointed marshal in town. Now, this is appointed like, "Hey, Jen, you're going to be the town marshal." "Okay, thanks." Like, literally, that's how he was picked. David Dunbar. Dunbar had already been warned about McElroy. And if he was crossed, Dunbar would be in the same spot. And he knew that. That's what they told him. If you cross this man, you're going to be in his crosshairs.
So
it's not going to be good. Beau's 70th birthday and party celebration is coming up. It's July 8th, 1980. Ken McElroy spent most of the day in the tavern drinking and griping about Beau Bonecamp. Mm. Beau Bonecamp needed to be taught a lesson, and he was the man that was going to do it.
Could you imagine sitting there having nobody likes him?
And he's just going on.
And he's just going on and on and on, and people don't have the guts to say, shut the hell up.
Outside the tavern, 4 teenage boys were just hanging out doing what teenage boys do on a hot summer day in the Midwest, leaning against the truck, drinking their soda pops and watching the fine 2 ladies in town, right? 2 girls, whatever. They're just doing what they're doing. They're teenagers. At approximately 7:30 that evening, Beau drove back to the store to meet an electrician who he was going to meet because the air conditioner inside the store had broke and he was there to fix it. At approximately 7:30 that evening, Beau drove back to the store to meet an electrician who was going to fix the broken air conditioner inside the store. Now, Beau took a knife to the back loading dock. He was going to break some boxes down while the electrician was inside working. And that is when he noticed the approaching green truck with McElroy driving it. McElroy pulled right up to the dock and asked if Beau had phoned the police yet.
The police.
The police. No, Beau said, puzzled. I mean, that was weird. Why would I be calling the police? Beau added, and this could have been the one that tipped him off, that this is private property. And McElroy, you need to go. Probably not the good thing to say.
No, I don't think so.
McElroy shouted back, "No one tells me what to do."
Oh, I love men like that.
McElroy got back in his truck and went back to the tavern where he offered the young boys $5 and told them to go inside and get a soda. Why would he do that, Jen?
So there's no witnesses.
Bo went back inside the store, and upon returning back to the dock, he was met with a double-barreled shotgun in his face. Moments later, that gun exploded, and Bo was shot. Immediately, people in the tavern jumped up and shut the door. Yeah, you heard me. They shut themselves inside because they knew McElroy was right out there and did
They're
that.
They're no dummies.
Right?
They probably locked it too, correct?
Locking them inside.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what I thought was pretty interesting, and good for you, Steve-O. It was a teen boy named Steve Day who actually ran for the door and ran outside to the store where he found Bo laying on the ground, blood pouring from the two bullet wounds. It was a teenager. Do you believe that? All those grown men shut the door. Grown women shut the door. And the teenager goes out there and helps. Yay, Steve-O. Bo was rushed to the hospital, and at this point, they were unsure if he would survive. People knew who did it, but wondered why. As the police began investigating, two officers pulled Dunbar aside, and they whispered to him. Now, Dunbar's the marshal, remember, that he was appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And they told him, if you ever run into McElroy and there's no one else around, take him out. Yep. Dunbar stated, if you can't handle him, how the hell do you think I'm supposed to?
Wow.
One guy, right?
Right. So,
but well, I mean, it
sounds like it's still.
It was like a little 22-year-old kid or something that they appoint for the marshal, you know what I mean?
Right.
To try to make people feel better, and then they never help them. They all knew there was only one police officer McElroy feared, Corporal Richard Dean Stratton. Over the years, Stratton had his share of dealing with McElroy. The evening that Bo was shot, Stratton was directing traffic and listening to police scanners. That's when he heard the call come out. Stratton began formulating a plan, and that was to get between Ken and the Missouri River. He knew what Ken would do, which was cross the Missouri River into Kansas and lay low and get rid of evidence. So Stratton had been dealing with him, and that's what he'd do. When he'd steal cattle, things like that, mm-hmm. he would just go to the Kansas City side, get a hotel, lay low for a while, right? And kind of get rid of evidence.
Right.
Different state.
Can't go across straight lines.
Exactly.
State lines. Wow.
Stratton jumped in his cruiser, and he pulled into town. And like magic, McElroy pulled up right across from him with Trina next to him. And he pulled over, and he was like looking around all shocked and said, huh, what's going on?
Blame
Stratton
him.
Pulled him over, pulled him out, slowly took control, got him out of the truck, cuffed him, and took him. Took them in. When it was over, it was finally over. No. No, it wasn't. It was never over. Police couldn't hold Tarina for anything, as she was not with him at the time of the shooting of Bo and Camp. 10 minutes after Tarina was released, the telephone rang at Stratton's home. Stratton's wife, Margaret, answered, and a man's voice said, something bad is going to happen to your husband. He's not going to live until the trial.
Click. Oh, nice.
Later, as Stratton and another police officer named Rhodes were talking, and this was at the police station
right
in St. Joe, McElroy approached them. He looked Rhodes in the eye and he said, you got an oak bookcase in your study that has a top shelf filled with books bound in leather. Three of the books are red, three are brown, two are black. Saying nothing, Rhodes and Stratton turned and walked outside. Rhodes said, he's never been inside my house. And as far as I know, he's never been at my door, Rhodes said. He's right on the bookcase and the colors, but wrong on the number of books. The men went back inside and asked McElroy how he knew about the books. McElroy says, I saw them through the scope on my high-powered rifle. McElroy replied nonchalantly with a grin crossing his face. That's part two.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So,
wow, Camille. Seriously, I cannot believe that he gets away with all of this. And we're not even halfway. Well, we are halfway done. Right? We hope?
I think.
That's amazing.
I went back and cut out so much, but like, there's just so much to it to
right.
see how it all piles on top of each other. And
right.
the more he does, the more he gets away with, then the more he does.
It's and like, the more goes, people get tired of it.
Yep.
And
so,
but nobody does anything.
No,
yet.
Well, I mean, the police officers can't even do anything. And he knows that.
I know.
You know,
that's
the courts can't do anything.
Scary.
The judge is afraid of him.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know what? It's not. He was smart enough to know to go, you know, if I was mad at you and harassing you, what else is going to, he would go like burn down your parents' house
right.
to get back at you too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, like most people, they would threaten your family.
Yeah.
Because you would
good.
Care more about your family getting hurt than
right,
yourself.
Right. So hopefully we can wrap this up in two more episodes.
Next week.
We're going to squeeze it together, hopefully.
We're going to do it next week because we don't want to bore you all. We know you have weekend lives and other podcasts maybe you listen not, to.
But yeah.
Even though the other podcasts probably aren't as cool as we are.
They are. They're way cooler. But that's okay.
That's okay.
That's okay.
We get it. We understand.
Yep.
That's and okay. We love you for listening.
We love our nerdy side. So we you want to tell the good people where they can find us?
You can find us on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can find us on Facebook. And we have a blog, ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Sometimes you put a www before. Sometimes you don't have to. Depends on how finicky your browser is or the interwebs or whatever it is. If you would like to be a part of our awesome Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast and sign up. You get awesome swag from us. If you also would like to help support us, if you go to our website, ourtruecrimepodcast.com. There is a place where you can do a one-time donation that'll go to our PayPal. There is also a place that will take you to our Etsy store where you can buy our logo branded t-shirts and such.
Which are very cool.
They're very cool. They're very soft and they're very comfy. And I'll tell you what, we're getting some other designs worked on as we speak.
Woo!
So anyway.
Well, thanks, Jen. And let me leave you with this little tidbit of info when you have a stalker in your town.
Mm-hmm.
Lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya. By the way, there's a town called Tiptoe in the United Kingdom.
Tiptoe through the tulips. I wonder if that's why where you got that song. Not really. Okay.
I wonder if it was somebody's name.
A terrible name.
McBadden.
It is McBadden.
Stupid butthead.
41-year-old farmer, Romaine Henry. Which I love that name, by the way. Romaine Henry. Romaine like lettuce, and he's a farmer.
Right, that's what I was going to say. My joke was going to be, did he raise lettuce?